today on Against the Grain. They were forcibly removed from their homes and imprisoned in remote camps during World War II for the sole reason that they were of Japanese descent. I'm CS. Charles Wohlenberg and Paul Kitagaki Jr. discuss the human and legal impact of the wartime incarceration of Japanese Americans, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. When Pearl Harbor was attacked in December 1941, about 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry resided on the U.S. mainland. Most lived on the West Coast. About two-thirds were U.S. citizens born and raised here. 2 months after Pearl Harbor, Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, clearing the way for the forcible removal of Japanese Americans living on the West Coast and their incarceration in remote camps for the duration of World War II. Much has been said about this flagrant violation of constitutional rights, and perhaps you already know quite a bit about this tragic episode. But I'll wager that a fair bit of what we'll present today will be new to you. Charles Wohlenberg has written a book about several key legal cases provoked by the wartime incarceration of Japanese Americans and the attorney who spearheaded them. He also traces rancorous disputes within the American Civil Liberties Union around the proper approach to take. Paul Kitagaki Jr. has produced a book featuring the stories and photographs of dozens of survivors of the wartime concentration camps and their descendants. What did they go through? How did they feel about their incarceration? Do they think that such a thing could happen again to another population in the U.S., like Muslim Americans? We begin the hour with Charles Wohlenberg, former chair of social sciences and professor of history at Berkeley City College. His most recent book is Rebel Lawyer: Wayne Collins and the Defense of Japanese American Rights, and he spoke about it in early 2019 at an event sponsored by Shaping San Francisco. Here's a portion of Chuck's remarks.
One of the things that got me to write this book was during the campaign when Donald Trump said that, as far as he was concerned, Executive Order 9066 was a positive historical precedent for his proposals to limit Muslim immigration to the United States. And William Faulkner, I think, once said that the past isn't dead, it's not even past. Well, in a sense, Executive Order 9066 and the issues that it raised are not dead, they're not even past. And that's why we have to keep these discussions going. At the time of the executive order, which was issued by President Roosevelt in February of 1942, and of course, as I'm sure most of you know, the executive order had the effect of removing and incarcerating all people of Japanese descent who lived on the West Coast, 120,000 people, the majority of whom were American citizens, the majority of whom were California residents. And when the executive order was issued, Wayne Collins was a San Francisco attorney in his early 40s. He had a modestly successful one-man law practice. He'd provide legal services for middle and working class people and small businesses. But his real passion, his real interest, was in civil rights and civil liberties. And in 1934, he had been one of several people who got together and formed the Northern California branch of the American Civil Liberties Union in San Francisco. He served on the board of the Northern California branch for years and years and years. He argued cases for the Northern California branch, almost always pro bono without collecting fees. And he became a close associate and friend of Ernest Bessig. Bessig, like Wayne Collins, is another one of those really important people that almost no one has heard of. But Bessig was the executive director of the Northern California branch of the American Civil Liberties Union for something like 35 years, from the 30s through the 70s, and was an integral part of almost every progressive issue and and certainly any kind of legal issue that was going on in San Francisco during that time. And Collins became involved in a series of legal actions and legal cases involving the rights of Japanese Americans during the 1940s through Bessig and through the Northern California branch through that work. The book is not a full biography, but I do talk quite a bit about Collins's background and his personal life. But most of the book, and what I want to emphasize tonight, deals with the three big cases that Collins argued during the 1940s on Japanese American rights, along with many other cases. But the three big ones were the Korematsu case, the Renunciant case, and the Tokyo Rose case. The Korematsu case involved this young man, Fred Korematsu, born and raised in the East Bay, a graduate of Oakland High School, a blue-collar guy, a welder. And he was one of a tiny group of people, just a mere handful of people, who refused to obey the executive order. He was arrested, and he allowed Collins and the Northern California branch to use his case to challenge the constitutionality of the executive order, to quite literally challenge the right of President Roosevelt to issue that order. And because of that, the Korematsu case is, I think, the most important of all the legal cases that came out of the incarceration process. Collins took that appeal all the way up, took that challenge all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And although Collins had actually gotten his law education in a night school for kind of working class kids, he argued the case before the Supreme Court. All the other lawyers who were arguing there were graduates of Ivy League colleges, and that in and of itself was a kind of an interesting social dynamic. But Collins argued before the Supreme Court in 1944, but in December of that year, the court, by a 6-3 margin, voted that the executive order was constitutional, and therefore Fred Korematsu's conviction was legal and proper. 39 years later, in 1983, Federal District Judge Marion Hall Patel, here in San Francisco, overturned Fred Korematsu's original 1942 conviction. And in the process, she used almost all the same arguments that Wayne Collins had originally introduced into the case back in 1942. Collins died in 1974 at the age of 74. So the 1983 overturning of Korematsu's conviction came 9 years after his death. But even so, I felt it was right in the book to kind of treat it as, at least in part, a posthumous victory for Wayne Collins, because so many of the arguments that he had made were finally found to be relevant. The Renunciant case involved more than 5,000 people who were imprisoned at the Tule Lake Camp in northeastern California, who renounced their American citizenship. Tule Lake was one of the 10 original camps that were established, and for its first year or two of operation, it was not unlike any of the other camps. But in 1943, the federal government decided to concentrate all the people that the government classified as troublemakers or disloyals or no-no boys or no-no girls, to concentrate them all at Tule Lake. And once that happened, conditions at Tule Lake deteriorated dramatically, and things, as bad as things were at the other camps, they were much, much worse at Tule Lake. And again, I go into a lot of that in the book, the specifics. But I think it was those conditions and the social upheaval and almost paranoia in some cases that those conditions created that led to more than 5,000 people. That's about almost a third of the people who were at Tule Lake renounced their American citizenship. In the summer of 1945, as the war was winding down, the federal government told the renunciants that since you guys have voluntarily given up your citizenship, we now are classifying you as enemy aliens, and we will deport you to Japan. These were all people who had been born in the United States. Most of them had never been to Japan. Many of them couldn't speak the Japanese language, and yet they were scheduled to be deported to Japan. Wayne Collins was the only lawyer, at least initially, the only lawyer who would even take the case. And the case that he took ended up lasting 23 years. It wasn't until 1968 that the final plaintiffs in the renunciant case finally had their cases resolved. But over that 23-year period, Collins was able to prevent anybody from being involuntarily deported. And he also eventually got more than 90% of the plaintiffs received full American citizenship, restoration of their citizenship. It was certainly the most successful case that Collins argued during this period. And it's also, I think, a very important case about citizenship, about basic constitutional issues regarding citizenship. And because of that, I'm really surprised that it isn't very well known, even among legal scholars, let alone the general public. The third case, the Tokyo Rose case, involved this young woman, Iva Taguri de Aquino, born and raised in Southern California, a UCLA graduate. In 1941, she made her first trip to Japan to visit a sick relative, and she got stuck there when the war began, or the war opened up. And eventually, the Japanese government required her to make English language broadcasts aimed at American soldiers and sailors serving in the Pacific. She actually was one of more than a dozen young women who made these English language broadcasts. And the GIs who heard the broadcast kind of collectively called all of them, quote unquote, Tokyo Rose. But of all those women, those more than a dozen women, she was the only one who refused to give up her American citizenship. And it's one of the great ironies of her story, that this gesture of loyalty to the United States was really what got her into trouble. Because after the war, the U.S. government decided that she had been a U.S. citizen who gave aid and comfort to the enemy. And therefore, she was indicted on treason charges. And Wayne Collins defended her in a 13-week treason trial that was held here in San Francisco in the old federal court building down on 7th Street. It was kind of a 1940s version of a media circus. The prosecution was never able to provide any direct evidence that she ever said or did anything that was against the United States. She was basically a disc jockey. But she was convicted. She served 6 years in a federal prison. She had to pay a $10,000 fine, and that $10,000, was a lot of money then. And she had her American citizenship stripped from her. They also tried to deport her, but Collins at least prevented the deportation. Collins called it America's Dreyfus case, and for the rest of his life, he tried to get her conviction overturned either by judicial means or by presidential pardon. And in 1977, 3 years after his death, President Gerald Ford pardoned Iva Taguri de Aquino. I believe she's the only person convicted of treason that's ever received a full unconditional pardon, including full restoration of her rights of citizenship, including voting rights. She was about 60 when she got her pardon. She lived another 30 years. She died at age 90, and I think in 2007. One of the things that's hard for us to imagine is how great the odds were against Collins in these cases. I mean, he was fighting the American government, the American president. Overwhelming public opinion was against him. Overwhelming media and editorial opinion was against him. In fact, even the national leaderships of both the American Civil Liberties Union and the Japanese American Citizens League were against Collins in these cases, at least initially during the first years. In 1942, when Collins was writing his first brief in the Korematsu case, the national board of the ACLU back in New York voted not to challenge the constitutionality of Executive Order 9066. And so they ordered Collins to cease and desist. They ordered Collins to drop the case. And Collins, if you read the book, you'll see he was not the kind of guy who took orders very well. Collins refused to drop the Korematsu case. And eventually the Northern California branch and Ernest Bessig supported Collins in that. The Korematsu case and Collins's unwillingness to drop the case created a rift between the New York and San Francisco offices of the ACLU that lasted for another quarter century or more. During much of that time, those two offices were operating as if they were completely separate organizations. Collins, for the rest of his life, looked upon the national office of the ACLU as sort of traitors to the cause. He often said that the only real civil liberties union in the United States is the Northern California branch in the San Francisco office.
That's Charles Wohlenberg speaking about his book, Rebel Lawyer, Wayne Collins and the Defense of Japanese American Rights, published by Heyday. He spoke at a 2019 event sponsored by Shaping San Francisco, a participatory community history project that documents and archives stories and memories of San Francisco. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and we'll return to more of Wohlenberg's talk later this hour. We turn now to a conversation I had with the photojournalist Paul Kitagaki Jr. about his book, Behind Barbed Wire, Searching for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. The book is the culmination of a long pilgrimage. Paul spent more than a decade tracking down and photographing survivors of the wartime concentration camps and their descendants. He also collected oral histories. When Paul Kitagaki Jr. joined me recently, he told me about the initial inspiration for this project.
Yeah, so in 1979, my Uncle Nobo Kitagaki, who was an artist in San Francisco, had told me that Dorothea Lange had photographed our family as they were leaving for the incarceration camp in Oakland. And, you know, Dorothea Lange, she's like one of the best documentary photographers, and she's like my photographic hero. So I really wanted to know what this photograph looked like. And I had the opportunity in 1984, I was covering Gary Hart on the campaign trail for the San Francisco Examiner, and we ended up in Washington, D.C. So I went to the Library of Congress and the National Archives. And at the National Archives, I searched through over 900 of Dorothea Lange's photographs that are archived there. And I flipped through these boxes of photographs. They're like probably like 4x5 contact sheets with a caption typed on the back of the photographs. And I searched and searched for these photographs. I didn't know what the family photograph is going to look like, but I finally found the photograph. And in this photograph, my grandmother, my grandfather, my dad, and his sister. And they're all wearing their best clothes, their Sunday best clothes. They're all wearing number tags on their clothing. And I couldn't believe it. My grandmother, she's 53 at the time. She's looking up, smiling at this white person. I'm thinking, why are they smiling? You know, it's like such a, you know, they're uprooted from the home. They lost their business. They're leaving Oakland. They're not sure where they're going. And I found out later on that this woman, Dorothea Hightower, was a family friend, and she had come to wish them good luck and goodbye. And her family had also stored a lot of my family's personal belongings while they were away.
So where did they go on that bus from Oakland? And what was your dad's, because you write about this in this book, what was your dad's, Kiyoshi Kitagaki's, experience at the camp like?
On that day, which was May 6, 1942, they were waiting for this bus in Oakland at the control center, and this bus was going to take them to the Tan Fran racetrack, which is in San Bruno. They didn't know where they were going, so they ended up boarding that bus, driving across the bay in this bus, and arrived at Tan Fran. And luckily, they didn't have to stay in one of the horse stalls that a lot of people had to stay in. They had constructed some other temporary barracks built of wood and tar paper in the middle of the racetrack. So that's where they stayed. And it was just terrible. After that, they ended up going to when the permanent camp was built in Delta, Utah, which is south of Salt Lake City, in the middle of the desert. It was called the Topaz War Relocation Center. And that's where they spent the duration of the war. And it's like hot and dusty and the wind would blow and the food was terrible.
Kiyoshi, your dad, his parents had run a laundry business in Oakland before they were forcibly relocated. Were they able to restart that business later on after the war, after they returned from the concentration camp?
When my family returned home to Oakland, they had a, as you were mentioning, they had a laundry dry cleaning business in Oakland on Piedmont Avenue, and they were not able to return there. And then my grandparents had no way to make a, you know, my grandfather was 68 and he had no way to make a living. So he ended up cleaning houses in Berkeley and Piedmont. And my grandmother did the same thing. She also found work cleaning houses. And later on, when they were able to, they became U.S. citizens. But they couldn't buy a house. So all the, you know, my uncles, Nobu and Moria, who were in the U.S. Army during World War II, helped them. And my dad, after the war, he was in the Army Air Force. They helped get my grandparents a house in West Oakland.
When you began asking your parents and your grandparents about their incarceration experiences, how did they respond? What was their reaction?
Well, it's really interesting. I never knew about the incarceration. I learned about it in a history class in 1970, and I was 16 years old, and that's the first time I've ever heard of it. You know, my parents never spoke of it. And then my grandparents, I didn't speak a lick of Japanese, and my grandparents just spoke Japanese. So there was no conversation there. And then even when I learned about it and talked to my parents about it, they really didn't explain how they felt about it, or, you know, the injustice of it, or they do say, oh, the food was bad, it was just kind of a hard time, and they would let it go. And that was, you know, that's really common with so many other Japanese American families. Their parents never spoke about it.
Let's talk about some of the other people featured in your book. I think there's more than 60 people that you tracked down, photographs of whom you had found taken in the 1940s by Dorothea Lange and other photographers. Kiyoshi Katsumoto, he was 6 when he and his family were taken first to Tanforan, again in San Bruno. It was a racetrack, Tanforan racetrack. What did he notice about the horse barns there in which many people were made to live?
Yeah, Kiyoshi was 6 when he left. He and his family had left. They were farming out in Centerville, which is today is Fremont. When he went to Tanforan, his family's actually pretty lucky. They live in the barracks rather than the stables. But what stuck with Kiyoshi when he was exploring around Tanforan one day was by the stables was the smell of manure and all those places where people were just living. And there was just like a sea of muck, he said, and it really just stank terribly, it said. And then he looked in one of these stables and he saw this woman sitting on a cot. And he even noticed like the horse hair that was embedded in the wooden walls. And he could just feel like her sadness just sitting there.
What did Katsumoto, what did he tell you about his experience at Topaz, which is where he eventually ended up?
So, you know, when they all left for the camps, everybody had to wear a number tag. Every family had a number, and that was attached to their clothing and also to their luggage. And what he recalls is that his family number was 21365. And, you know, he recalled how it was all etched into their belongings and labeled on their clothes and everything else. And he said later on in life, he goes, you know, that's what we were reduced to, he said. We were reduced to a number. And he also said it was like a concentration camp by any means or names, whatever you want to put on, he said. I mean, because they were prisoners. They didn't have the freedom to walk anywhere that you wanted to go. They were confined within the borders of the barbed wire and the guard towers. And you got to remember, these guard towers, they had soldiers in there with the guns, and the guns were not pointing out, they were pointing in.
Mei Yanagi, she was also sent off to the Topaz camp. That's in Utah. She was 7 years old when she was sent, I presume in 1942. She told you about the dust.
So when Mei went, they were farming in Hayward, California. And her father had a nursery. And when they left, they went to Utah. And she never forgot her first Utah winter. She goes, it was her first experience with snow. And it's like really exciting, she said. But later on, when that snow mixed with that thick desert dust, it would get kind of mucky and you'd get tramped in and became like a crust. And when her father owned a house, and her dad had left the care of the business, the nursery business and the house in the care of a person, this business person. So when they returned home, this guy had sold the house from under them and they had nowhere else to go. So the family settled in Berkeley, and then her dad had to restart life as a gardener. And there's another photograph that Dorothea Lange had taken of her sister. What's really incredible is Mei and her sister, Jane, they were both school teachers. And both of them, they could never talk about the incarceration to their students. For her sister Jane, it just like these emotions would well up and she just couldn't talk about it.
Paul Kitagaki Jr. is my guest. He's an award-winning photographer and videographer. We are talking about his book, Behind Barbed Wire, Searching for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We hear sometimes, or maybe we assume, Paul, that many families were forcibly relocated together. They were picked up, they were sent to the assembly centers, they were sent off to these one of the 10 permanent camps. And yet, well, let's take Yodo Itashiki, who was a San Francisco resident at the time that her family was taken. What happened to her parents as a result of the incarceration?
Yoko Itashiki, who was 7 at the time, her mom was arrested right away, right after Pearl Harbor, because her mom taught Japanese language in San Francisco. So the mom was separated from the family, and her father and her other sister, they went to Tanf Ran. Her mom went to this special camp in Sharp Park in Pacifica. And then the family ended up in Topaz in Utah. But what the sad part is that her mom died and separated from the family. So she never saw her mom until years later when they brought her mom's body back to Topaz for the funeral. And she goes, you know, she said that it was really traumatic because her body came back and we had a funeral in Topaz. She said, but it was really hard for me being a child seeing her like that when I hadn't seen her for a long time. But the incredible thing that she said was, but I don't have any bitterness.
Wow. How did you respond when she said that? Or what did you think?
I just couldn't believe how such a tragic thing could happen. And she was so young. She could just, I don't know. I think it might be that Japanese concept called shigatakanai, which means it can't be helped. That could be some of it, just how she just kind of let it go, that the whole experience.
I'm looking at your book, Helena Nakamoto. After she and her family were interned, her brother Katsumi actually died in camp. Did this happen to a significant degree? Did the death of family members in the camps, was that a phenomenon?
Some of the subject I photographed, there's a few of them where their family members had passed away because the conditions were very hard there. You know, there's so much dust and stuff. I thought there's a lot of respiratory problems. The food was, you know, there's a lot of sickness from the food, bad food and stuff too. So there's a lot of sickness, but there's also, I think, the stress of being in camp, that experience being locked away, losing everything. You know, even though like 2/3 of the Japanese Americans were American citizens, they were not treated that way. They were treated as an enemy alien or combatant and locked up behind the barbed wires. So I think it was very stressful for so many of the people there.
Mitsunobu Kojimoto, he was 19 years old. In 1942, he waited to be taken to an assembly center in Southern California. This was a picture was taken of him waiting for the bus. He was a U.S.-born citizen. What was going through his mind as he waited to be forcibly removed?
That photograph was taken at 2020 Van Ness Avenue in San Francisco, which is now a Jiffy Lube. But he was like, you know, he went to high school, graduated. The day he heard the news, he was playing basketball in the gym at the YMCA in San Francisco, and he heard the news. And he goes, when they had the notice to move out, they said, we're being kicked out of San Francisco. And he thought it was really shocking because as you grow up, you think you're going to have certain rights of life, liberty. And he goes, so sitting there was very disheartening. And he really wanted somebody to come and rescue him because he learned all the civics and all the history, all your rights as a citizen. And he was just very disheartened that they took away his rights.
Your book combines, it juxtaposes your photographs, the photographs you took I think from between 2005 to basically the present, with the photographs taken by Dorothea Lange and other photographers in the early 1940s. What was your aim in doing this?
Do you remember when I was talking about when I was back at the National Archives and I was looking through those Dorothea Lange photographs? And as I flipped through those photographs, all those faces staring up at me, I really wanted to know the story behind each of those photographs. I wanted to know what happened to that family and how do they survive this tragic event in their life. So what I started to do is there was this book called Executive Order 9066. It was put out by the California Historical Society in 1972. And in that book was a lot of Dorothea Lange photographs. There's a couple of Ansel Adams photographs. There's also a Clem Albers and some other of the photographers that shot for the War Relocation Authority. Those are the photographers who documented the incarceration for the War Relocation Authority. And I really wanted to know more. And it took me a really long time to track down all the people in the photographs, because most of the photographs don't have a name, but don't identify who's in the photograph. It would have a place and a date, but no name. So what I had to do is I had to take these photographs to churches and different places and say to somebody, hey, do you recognize who's in this photograph? It took a long time. From 2005 to like 2012, I mainly just found like 12 people. And I had an exhibit at the San Bruno BART station, of all places, which is where the Tanfran Assembly Center was. Since that time, since 2012 to like 2019, I got another 48 people, and I have another 5 that I just photographed last year, too.
BART being the, for those people who aren't in the Bay Area, that's the light rail system of the Bay Area. What kind of camera did you choose to use for this project?
Yeah, so I chose to use a 4x5 Linhof camera, and I shot black and white film. And the reason why I chose that was most of the photographers back in the 40s, they shot mostly with 4x5. And I wanted their photograph and my photograph to kind of have the same sort of feeling, even though mine is like 70 years later. I wanted there to be a marriage of both images and the feeling that are in the images.
What qualities of your subjects, of the people who you photographed, which of their qualities do you think your photographs tend to capture, if you can generalize?
You know, I really think their character is at quiet strength. It's like the title for my exhibit is Gambate, which means to keep trying. It's like that quiet strength. You just keep on trying and trying. I think they all have that. And, you know, it's kind of funny. When you first take a photograph of somebody, everybody likes to smile, you know? So when I first start, they'd be smiling. I go, no, I want you to think about, this is a serious subject, I said. We need to kind of think about the moment back in the day. I mean, it's kind of hard. Some of you are like 5 years old, but I just want you to think about the experience and your family or your parents or something like that. So that's, I was trying to capture something that kind of showed their strength that they had.
And you mentioned Gambare, the exhibition. So just to say that the book Behind Barbed Wire by my guest Paul Kitagaki Jr. is based on a traveling exhibition called Gambate, Legacy of an Enduring Spirit, which appeared at the Smithsonian and in cities around the country. The book expands the project to include Kitagaki's own story and more photographs. In many cases, Paul, you photographed people at the sites that were the scenes of their wartime trauma, for example, where they were waiting for the bus to be taken away from their homes and their home cities. How did people react to that, or react to your suggestion to return to those places?
You know, I tried to photograph as many people as I could in the same exact location where the original photograph was made. And everybody was very on board for doing that. I was trying to explain exactly what I was trying to show, the before and after of a situation. I mean, for some of the older people, due to health or logistics, we couldn't photograph them in the exact same location, but I tried to, when I photographed them at their homes or wherever, I try to incorporate something about their personality that would kind of feel like that photograph taken in the 40s.
You've got a photo in your book of Thomas Yoneda. Tell us about his father, Goso Carl, with a K, Yoneda, and why he was picked up by the FBI after the Pearl Harbor attack in December 1941.
Yeah, so Thomas's dad, Goso Carl Yoneda, he was a member of the Communist Party, and he also was very instrumental in the labor union. He was also he was the first Asian American member of the International Longshoremen and Warehouse Union in San Francisco, and he had changed his Japanese name to Carl to honor Karl Marx, and he had met his wife Elaine Buckman during all these labor protests back in the day, back in the 30s, when they were trying to get better pay for the longshoremen and all the the cannery workers. And his dad was a very big labor organizer up and down the West Coast. But he married this woman, and Thomas was a Hapa kid, which is, half Japanese, half Caucasian. And after Pearl Harbor, his dad was picked up because he was on the FBI list. But his dad was sent to Manzanar, and his dad had helped build the camp in Manzanar. And then shortly after war started, 6 months later, his dad enlisted in the U.S. Army, which was seeking linguists. And his dad, he passed his language test, and he was in the military intelligence service in the Pacific Theater War, like in China and Burma and India. And what's another incredible story about their family was, this is like in August 7th, 1945. Thomas was in school. This is back in San Francisco. And it was the day the atomic bomb was dropped, he said. And he goes, this teacher was making an announcement. And I was standing all by myself, he said. And all these kids were yelling about Hiroshima. The Japs got it, blah, 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 he said. And then all he could think about was that his grandmother was in Hiroshima. And it wasn't until after the war that they learned that his grandmother had survived.
You note in your book the kind of the wave of violence that was directed against Japanese Americans returning to California after their incarceration ended. Tell us about that, and tell me what Tadao and Yukio Yoshikawa's parents did as a result.
Tadao and his brother, his dad, when they returned to Stockton, California, his dad had lost his business, but they didn't lose their home. His dad was a barber. So when they moved back, they put mattresses against the windows because they were so afraid of people throwing rocks through the windows while they were sleeping.
Right, and this is a theme, right, that people, after their incarceration experience was over, it wasn't just, okay, well, in fact, maybe in some isolated cases, they could get their businesses back, they could return to their livelihoods, but there was always that matter, it seems, of people judging them for who they were, which was of Japanese descent.
Yeah, I mean, returning home, like in the Vacaville area, there were signs, we don't want Japs here. There's so many other places where people just wrote, we don't want Japs here, don't come back. It was just very terrible. I mean, there's no support for them coming home. And you got to remember, a lot of them lost their homes and their businesses, and they really had to struggle to start again.
A number of people you talked to weighed in on the targeting of Muslim Americans after 9/11. What did they tell you?
Yeah, so after 9/11, so many of my subjects have said they spoke out in support of the Muslim Americans because they could see the same thing happening to them just because of the color of the skin or their ethnicity. And they could see the same thing happening to that group of people that happened to them in 1940s. And back in the 40s, there was nobody there to speak out and support them. So they felt it was so important for them to speak out and say, hey, you can't do that. They're American citizens. You can't do that just because of the way they look or their race.
So as we said, this book, Behind Barbed Wire, is based on a traveling exhibition. What's the fate of that exhibition? Do you plan to show these photographs in museums and other such venues in the future?
Yeah, we're looking for more venues to share this story. I mean, it's so incredible because once people see and read the story, they have a human connection with. It doesn't matter which race you are, but you could read the human stories, and everybody has a connection with that. So I think it's so important to share these stories all through the United States and, you know, around the world. So hopefully something like this wouldn't happen again. Or maybe if somebody are thinking about something like this, they would maybe stop and think about it for a second and maybe stop something from like this happening again.
Paul Kitagaki Jr. is his name, Kitagaki. He's an award-winning photojournalist and documentary photographer, and he has been working at the Sacramento Bee since 2003 as a photographer, and he is author and photographer of Behind Barbed Wire, Searching for Japanese Americans Incarcerated During World War II. Paul, congratulations on this book. The photographs are stunning. The oral histories are amazing. Thank you so much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you, CS, for sharing my story and having me on. I really appreciate it.
And this is CS, and you are listening to Against the Grain. We return now to more of the talk given by Charles Wohlenberg about his book, Rebel Lawyer, Wayne Collins and the Defense of Japanese American Rights. Here is Wohlenberg speaking on February 6th, 2019.
In that same period, in early 1942, the leadership of the JACL, the Japanese American Citizens League, were primarily well-educated young Japanese American men who wanted access into the mainstream of American upper middle class life. And they advised Japanese Americans to obey the executive order and to cooperate with the government. The JACL leadership worked with the War Relocation Agency to administer the camps. JACL leaders were some of the first people to volunteer for service in the 442nd Regimental Combat Unit, that all Japanese American Army unit that had such a distinguished military record. And so from their point of view, Fred Korematsu and Wayne Collins were showing the rest of the American public that maybe Japanese Americans weren't good, loyal citizens. And so they were really critical of Fred Korematsu, and they opposed Collins' case for several years. Collins responded in kind. He said, as far as he was concerned, JACL stood for jackal. Collins was a guy who had a really explosive temper. And as he even admitted, he said, I never forgive, I never forget. 25 years later, in 1967, a new generation of JACL leaders tried to make amends by inviting Collins to a banquet where they would honor him for his contributions to Japanese American life. Collins not only turned down the invitation, but he said, as far as he was concerned, if the JACL really wanted to represent Japanese Americans, the JACL should immediately disband and disperse. This is 25 years later. Never forgive, never forget. This picture is the defense table at the Tokyo Rose trial. There's Wayne Collins in the foreground, and sitting next to him is a man named George Olshausen, which was one of two other attorneys that he brought with him to help in the case. The other attorney was a man named Ted Tamba. But standing behind Olshausen is Tetsujiro Nakamura, or often better known as Tex Nakamura. And he was important in the Tokyo Rose defense, but he was particularly important in the renunciant case. He had graduated from Cal in 1938, was going to go to law school, but couldn't afford to do it. So he took a job as a kind of legal assistant at a Sacramento office of a Japanese American lawyer. And he, like almost all other Japanese Americans in Sacramento, was imprisoned at Tule Lake. He didn't renounce his citizenship, but he became a kind of legal advisor to the renunciants. And he was the guy who convinced Wayne Collins to take the renunciant case. Collins agreed to take the case on a pro bono basis, no legal fees, but a court case involving 5,000 plaintiffs that was going to go on for more than 20 years cost a lot of money. And so Tex Nakamura organized what was called the Tule Lake Defense Committee. And over about a 13 or 14 year period, he collected somewhere, or the committee collected somewhere between $700,000 and $800,000 from within the Japanese community to support the renunciant case. In today's money, that'd be like $7 or $8 million. And Nakamura was the sort of executive secretary of the committee, so he became really a kind of almost a partner and a colleague of Collins. Nakamura eventually did go to law school, and he became a pretty important Southern California lawyer. He died 2 years ago at age 99, or 2.5 years ago at age 99. And then one other person who was really important, particularly in the renunciant case, is Chio Wada. The upper picture here is a picture of the marriage of Yori and Chio Wada in 1944 during the war. They were both Cal graduates, and Yori Wada eventually became a pretty important public figure here in San Francisco. And in 1980, Jerry Brown appointed him as the first Asian American regent of the UC system. Chio was the daughter of a man named Senri Nao, who was an art dealer and a longtime friend of Wayne Collins. And so right after the war, he hired Chio as his office secretary, just in time for an avalanche of paperwork created by the renunciant case. Tens of thousands of pages of legal documents and everything else. And in order to handle that, she organized a group of Japanese American volunteers who came into the office for years to handle this huge amount of paperwork. And I'm telling the story of Nakamura and Wada because I think it illustrates that Wayne Collins was not so much, you know, the savior of Japanese Americans, you know, the great white hope, but he was, in a sense, a kind of enabler. His cases enabled people to begin, people like Wada or Nakamura, to begin the process of organizing for justice within the Japanese community itself. And by the 1980s, those early organizing attempts had led to the redress movement, the powerful redress movement, which in 1988 had this really remarkable success. Congress passed and President Ronald Reagan signed the American Civil Liberties Act, which apologized for Executive Order 9066, which provided a $20,000 reparation payment for every living survivor of the removal and incarceration process, and which also included what they called a statement of fact. And it said, in effect, that the executive order was unnecessary, unconstitutional, and motivated primarily by racism and political expediency, not national security. And if you take away all the legal verbiage, that was essentially the argument that Wayne Collins made in his first brief in the Korematsu case back in the summer of 1942. And now 46 years later in 1988, 14 years after Wayne Collins' death, in effect, the Congress of the United States and the President of the United States were saying, you know, Wayne, you were right all the time. During the 1940s, during a time of war, Wayne Collins was willing to challenge the executive authority as commander-in-chief of one of the most powerful, popular, even beloved presidents in American history. And in the end, in the long run, it was Collins' interpretation of the Constitution that prevailed, even over that of Franklin Roosevelt. And that is really the legacy of Wayne Collins. That's the lesson that he's passed down to us in this generation. That is the real historical precedent of the story of Executive Order 9066. And so today, with Donald Trump in the White House, the question is, where is Wayne Collins when we really, 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 really need him again?
And we have time for one more excerpt from the event. Here's Chuck Wolenberg responding to a question about the treatment of Italian immigrants in the U.S. during World War II.
There were some Italian immigrants who were interned. Some, in other words, people who were Italian citizens. And in most cases, I think now they admit that it was done unjustly. There were a few Italian immigrants who may have actually been pro-Mussolini and stuff. But the great majority of Italian immigrants weren't interned. The great majority of German immigrants weren't interned. there were no Italian Americans or German Americans interned, although there were some who were actually prosecuted for, you know, for a crime. What happens with people of Japanese descent who live on the West Coast is all people of Japanese descent, no matter whether they're citizens or not citizens, they're not charged with any crime, but they are removed and incarcerated. And people of mixed race were removed and incarcerated. There was a white woman who was married to a Japanese man, and they had a child, and she went to the camp with him and her child. He then volunteered for service in the American Army and left. She said, okay, now I'll leave the camp. They said, well, you can leave the camp, but your kid has to stay. This 4-year-old kid is half Japanese. So it was the way they determined this was on race, on ethnicity. The other thing, the Chinese Exclusion Act actually was ended in 1943, right in the middle of World War II, when China was our ally, and this idea, how can we have this? But in the 1920s, the Chinese Exclusion Act was extended to Japanese, so that by the time World War II started, no Japanese could immigrate to the United States, just like no Chinese could immigrate to the United States, which is one of the reasons why when the internment occurred, the majority of people were already American citizens, because already there hadn't been any more Japanese immigrants coming in. So the majority of the people of Japanese descent in the United States, even by 1942, were American citizens. So it's, you know, I mean, the policies towards a lot of immigrants in America have been racist and discriminatory, but the policies towards Asian immigrants, and particularly Japanese immigrants, it's a whole different ballgame, really. It's just a whole different level of discrimination and racism.
Charles Wohlenberg, speaking about his book, Rebel Lawyer, Wayne Collins and the Defense of Japanese American Rights. Wohlenberg's other books include Berkeley, A City in History, and What's Going On, California and the Vietnam Era, which he co-edited with Marcia Iman. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.